You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. So glad you're with us today. On the program this afternoon, Computers and You. Peter Kimball is with us this afternoon. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. He's here to answer our questions about computers. Listeners, I welcome you to join us with a phone call. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, Peter, welcome back. Good to see you.
It's good to be back. A little chilly out there, but warm here in the studio, at
least.
Yeah,
okay. Well, already the phone lines are warming up, so let's take a call. A listener on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
A couple questions. I use Firefox, Mozilla Firefox, and there occasionally there's upgrades. And so every time I get an upgrade, I get another icon on my desktop. And so I've got eight icons, with Firefox set up. And what I want to know is, can I delete any of those icons without having an impact on the program the program?
Yes, those are simply shortcut icons that Firefox and many other programs will put on the desktop. In fact, when you delete them, you'll probably even get a pop-up message saying you're deleting a shortcut. You're not actually deleting the program itself, because some people want to do the opposite of what you're wanting, delete the whole program. But that's not going to happen with those icons. You'll generally see a real tip-off. The icons have a little arrow next to them, a little square with an arrow, and that tells you also that it's a shortcut. But you can delete all of those except the one.
Okay, because I have key one is looks like a fox around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And all the other upgrades are they're just a box with a disk in front that says Firefox setup.
Okay, well, in that event, what those are just access to the programs that actually do the setup. When you download an upgrade for Firefox, what will happen is that in case you're not able to run it or not able to complete it, it will put a shortcut on the desktop to get to the upgrade program. But if your updates have been done and successfully complete, you can delete all of those with no problem. Leave the one with the little fox. Your primary, but get rid of the other ones. Something else you can do in general, anytime you're wondering about that, for not only Firefox but for other programs, is you could create another folder on the desktop, which you can easily do by clicking the right mouse button and saying you want a new folder. Call it something like About to be Trashed or some such thing, and drag those other icons into place. They'll no longer be in their original location, and they'll sit there, and presumably, and certainly in this case, you'll have no difficulty with any of the software, and later on when you're comfortable with it, you can just go ahead and delete the contents of that folder.
Okay,
that would just be kind of in case there's something you're not sure it's okay to delete, move it where it is no longer where it was originally installed. And then if a program later on objects to not being able to find something, you can always move it back.
Oh, excellent, excellent. And another thing, I find that recently when I am working on the computer and I want to highlight a word or a sentence in red, then I do that, and it's red on the monitor. But then when I print it out, the print copy, it will be in a very pale yellow. It's hardly legible. And I just wondered, is that the... I'm hoping that's a problem with the print cartridge, but I just wondered if you had any ideas.
Well, is this, for example, from within Microsoft Word or some such program?
Yeah, Word.
So what you're doing is you're highlighting, and the highlight color is showing up... fine on the screen, and you can actually set which color you want it to be highlighted in within Microsoft Word.
Right.
And you're printing, and it's printing out as a pale yellow. When you print out other, like a photograph or a web page that has a lot of reds in it, do those photographs or do those images print looking properly?
I haven't tried doing that. It just recently occurred with alphanumerics narratives.
Well, it could well be that your printer... Printers don't actually have red ink in them. They have a combination, color printers have a combination of three primary colors of ink, cyan, magenta, and yellow. The magenta is not quite red, of course. And so it's a mixture of those colors that is going to give you the red, green, and blue colors that are the primary colors of light. And certainly if a printer is running out of one of those particular colors, you're not going to get accurate reds. The quick test would be to just print some photograph or print something else that has a wide range of color and see how it looks. The printer, some color printers have a single cartridge that has all three colors in it and perhaps a separate black cartridge. If yours is one of those, your only choice is going to be to replace that entire tri-color cartridge. Some slightly higher-end printers will have separate cartridges for cyan, magenta, yellow, and most printers in the installation software or the About My Printer software that gets installed with them give you a on-screen display of the printer's report of how much ink it has in its cartridges.
Yeah, I get that. Well, first, my printer does have the two cartridges. One is a color and one is a black. And then when I do print, I have a little thing in the bottom right corner of the screen that shows how much is left of each cartridge. And there's plenty left in the color cartridges.
Okay, all three, because a color cartridge should presumably show you three different values.
Actually, it just shows one value.
Okay, so it's just probably showing you the minimum of all of them. Well, then what I would do is two things. One, certainly test it out. You can see whether it's a problem with Microsoft Word's settings or not by just printing some other color image.
Okay.
From some other program. And if that prints properly, then you've pretty much eliminated the printer as a difficulty. There may be a setting in Microsoft Word that is simply sending the red out as a standard highlighting color, because highlighting traditionally is done with a yellow marker. And so that may be what Microsoft Word is sending out. I'm not sure precisely where one would go to fix that, but there are certainly tools and options and customization menu choices in Microsoft Word which may – are you using Word 2007 or 2003? Or do you know? Do you have the ribbon at the top, the big banner with all of the various tabs?
Actually, it's Windows 98.
Okay, so it's an older version still. So, yes, under tools and either customization or options, you may be able to find some printing settings. But the other thing that if you can't find it there, since this is an older version, and you have eliminated the printer as being the problem by printing out something that does show red properly, then you might want to just do a Google search for Word doesn't print red, or problems printing highlight in Word, various combinations. It might take you a few minutes to come up with the right combination of terms and see what the various settings would be. But the first choice, the first step would be to determine whether it's printer or the program.
Yeah, okay. So I'll find something with a large range of color. And the other, my last question is regarding the scanner. I just recently used a scanner yesterday, and when I ran the copy off the printer, even though the scanner was the stuff that was being scanned was in black, the printer printed out in green. It's never done that before. It's always been black, or unless I had a color on it. So I'm thinking it's related to this issue, but.
Well, that is definitely strange, and yes, it could be related. Again, do a test. See how that printer prints with something that's got a large number of colors.
Yeah.
It is possible in the scanning software itself to specify, in almost all scanning software that comes with scanners, to specify that you want, even if it's a color scanner, as most are, that you want the output to just be in grayscale, black and white, essentially. If that is specified and the printer is still printing it in green, then there may be a problem with the printer, or you may possibly be able to find a updated software driver for it that might address the difficulty. But it could also be at that point the printer starting to have difficulties. Again, assuming that the underlying test would be to print something from neither of those programs and see what kind of color rendition you get, and then make sure that your scanning software is set to output in grayscale or black and white. It'll probably be called grayscale. And
So there is a, like a control panel for this, for the scan system itself that would do.
Yes, almost every scanner that I've seen has software that's installed when you install the scanner, and among them are settings when you actually go in to do the scan itself, and you have the screen that controls.
Yes.
There will be someplace a set of settings or a set of options, and one of those almost invariably is: do you wish to scan colored, or do you wish the output to be colored? Do you wish it to be grayscale, black and white, in other words? And that's differently located on various software that supports different scanners, but it's almost certainly there.
Okay, great. Okay, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
You're very welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and it's our monthly look at computers today. Peter Kimball is our guest. He's the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium, Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your questions about computers for our guest this afternoon. You can join us with a telephone call if you've got a question. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Let's take another call now. A listener on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
We're moving to Bozeman, Montana, and I have a bunch of 3-inch floppies that I want to deaccess. Is there some way of recycling these things? You know, they're things like Hewlett-Packard printer drivers and all. I've got all these things on CD now. And I've just got these floppies, and I don't want to just throw them in the garbage.
Well, unfortunately, I'm unaware of any concern that or any business that will actually recycle those. What we've had to do with ours, with both the 3.5-inch floppies and a few years before that, the 5.25-inch,
yeah,
the ones that were really floppy, is to just throw them away, unfortunately.
What a shame.
I know.
That's very un-green.
It certainly is. And the problem is that most you can't really recycle them and reuse them. The process, my understanding, of taking them apart and trying to recycle the plastic is not particularly energy efficient in itself. Certainly, if any listeners have any additional information, I'd welcome it. But that's what we've had to do. I will mention it has nothing to do particularly with recycling, but you do want to make sure that if any of those happen to have old tax information or anything like that on them, that you thoroughly demagnetize them, which you could do with passing a strong permanent magnet back and forth over them a few times.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Sorry, I don't have a better suggestion. I felt bad about tossing them in the trash as well.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go and take a call on line two. Hello there.
I've got a Gmail question. Do you use that, or are you?
I don't use it as my primary mail program, but I can give it a shot.
I'll throw it out to you.
Okay.
I've just started using it since PrairieNet's going away. And I've noticed that I can't send something to myself. I used to once in a while. I can't even tell you why I would do it, but send it from myself to the same address, and it would come to my. I used Outlook Express, and it would go out and zip. There it was, right back. And it seems like with Gmail, if I try to copy myself on something, I send it. It gets sent, but it never shows back up again. And I figured, can't do that. And then I had a neighbor who just started using Gmail, and she just emailed me this morning and asked me the same question. And I thought, well, now there's two of us that are wondering why that doesn't happen. So.
Well, one of the certainly the email that you send it in Gmail will end up in your sent mailbox. So there's a mailbox for sent email,
right.
And it'll appear there.
Yeah.
And I'm just looking, a number of people have commented about this.
And then there was another instance where she posted something on our neighborhood listserv, and everybody else got it. But it, you know, went through the listserv and then came back to her, but she didn't get it, I guess, because it came and was from and to.
Right. And apparently that's the way, from what I'm just now looking at, that's apparently the way Gmail is set up. Somebody said, gee, one way that you could deal with this, set up an alternative, a copy Gmail account, which doesn't sound very ideal, and send it to them.
That's what I've done.
Well, okay. So maybe you wrote that note.
No, it seems kind of backward to have to do that.
It does. And I think one reason that the folks at Google did that was if there's 10 million email messages being sent an hour, that's 10 million more that they don't have to store.
Right.
So the other suggestion, but apparently people were not able to deal with this successfully in all cases, is try setting the mail preferences for composing and automatically blind carbon copy yourself. That would be something to try.
All right. Well, thanks for the
And that may be, according to this person, that may be the copy may well be in the, since it's going as a BCC, a blind carbon copy, it may be visible in your inbox.
Okay.
So that would be the that would be my best guess.
All right. Let's take another call. Listener on line three. Hi. Hi there.
I'm wondering if there are good security systems to add to a Mac. I got one in June, and I haven't bought one. A lot of people don't use them, but I'm beginning to see that maybe it's a good idea to get one.
As an antivirus and such, I presume.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's funny that you should mention that, because one of the things we were going to bring up today is that Apple has just updated their website recommending that not only one tool but even multiple antivirus applications be installed on Macintoshes. Their website suggests three, and let's see if I can remember them. Two of them. One is the Norton or the Symantec suite for Macintosh. One is the McAfee suite, and I don't know. The general advice that we've often given for Windows machines is you really don't want to have more than one antivirus program running. You want a good one, but you don't want more than one, because they can slow down the system and to some extent interfere with one another. And yet Apple is recommending on their website, on their support site, that more than one actually be installed. So both of those programs are well recommended. The Symantec, S-Y-M-A-N-T-E-C, and also the McAfee. And you could certainly find information out about both of those by just doing a Google search, for example, for Apple antivirus, or going to the Apple site. But it is definitely a good idea. There are certainly many more targeted attacks against Windows platforms, but they're out there for the Macintosh as well. And it is definitely a very wise thing to do. And unfortunately, a lot of people have gotten who use Macs have gotten to think, because they've had a little trouble, that they never will, and they may have gigabytes of information, relatively irreplaceable, photographs and correspondence and such on their Mac, and all it will take is one errant bit of software, and they've lost all of that. So, yes, you definitely want antivirus software, and there are several good ones. Those are a couple. Neither of them are free, because though you can get them very affordably, there is also the annual renewal fee, which allows the software and pays for the software to bring in updates, because there's a continuing effort on the part of antivirus vendors, McAfee, Symantec, and others, that is necessary to keep up with the latest viruses that are out there.
Well, one of the reasons I switched to the Mac, in addition to the fact that my Dell stopped communicating well with the outside world for the most part, was that the Symantec seemed to really slow down the computer. It checked, and it could be because of the settings that I have, but it checked every time one of my programs did something, it checked the file or checked the program, and so it would be waiting for a check for viruses. And I generally practice safe computing, but it really took forever to get things done. And then when it came time to renew the, or to do the annual update, it wouldn't let me do that. So I got pretty annoyed with the whole thing. And,
sure.
And I have a son who really believes in Macs and has been pestering me for years to get a Mac. So I thought, oh, well, might as well try it and see what makes a difference. I was going to ask you another question, and now it has gone out of my mind. Well, but thank you very much.
Yes. Well, given your experience with the Norton, you might want to take a look at the McAfee antivirus software for the Macintosh, but you definitely want to get something.
And I want to thank the listener for her call. And let's take another call, a listener on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I have XP, and my computer runs slow as it's getting older. And I was wondering at this disk cleanup, what does that do to my computer? What would that do to my computer?
Well, there are several different companies that make software known as disk cleanup software.
But this is under my system tool,
okay.
In my XP.
Okay, yes. So in that case, what it's going to do is it's going to look for various temporary files, various other files that are not there. I know exactly. I'm probably not going to be able to pull it up on this machine because of various security settings. But it will delete files that are no longer necessary because they are in temporary files. A lot of programs, when they install themselves or download various add-ons or updates, store some of the information into a temporary directory, and by definition, anything stored in those temporary directories is not necessary and can be deleted. Another program that's available to you from that same category is the disk defragmenter tool, which will, especially for older machines, make a fairly large difference, although it can take a long time to run. When files are written to a computer system, they are not written as one continuous block of instructions. Rather, computer systems will allocate the free space wherever it happens to be. And so that may mean that one program file could actually, in some extreme cases, be broken into 1,000 different segments, which the hard drive then has to retrieve one after another to put it back together. Defragmenting reorganizes things and tries to arrange it so that all of these programs are contiguous. That can also make a fairly big difference. I would also suggest that to speed it up, that you, if you haven't done so, that you try to download and run some of the adware and spyware programs such as SpyBot or AdAware, which may well find a number of programs that are running that you really don't need and were there just taking up system resources.
Well, it's really strange. The guy that worked on my computer put on a free spyware on there. And it actually blocks AdAware. It won't let me put AdAware. Won't let me run AdAware on my computer.
Well, that's I don't know which program that would be, but you can certainly from that program bring it up and temporarily disable it if you want to try to run.
Okay.
AdAware.
I didn't even realize that I could do that. Okay.
Yeah. Most all of those software programs, it's certainly not a good idea to leave them disabled, but they all have the ability to be temporarily disabled, necessary sometimes when you're installing or updating software.
On that disk cleanup, you said it would probably knock off my history and such then too, wouldn't it?
I don't think it will automatically knock off the history. You can do a lot of that. One thing that will bring out a lot of as I recall from running the program, you will have the option, a number of things that it can clean up, and among them will be temporary files that have been downloaded by your browser. I don't believe that includes the history. The history, the recollection of where you've been, is actually not a very large amount of disk space. What takes up a lot of the disk space with browsers are the storage of all of the various pages and images, and those you can easily delete. That just means the computer will have to download them next time you visit those sites.
Okay.
But you should have the options. And you can also explore it. As you get into disk cleanup, you'll have the option up until the very end to bail out and say, no, I don't want to do this. So you can see what it's asking you that it wants to be able to clear out.
Okay. All right. And just one comment about this defragmenter. I do that, and to your listeners, that it really does help speed up your computer. So thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. Let's take another call now for Peter Kimball, listener on line 1. Hi.
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 Question about AOL, maybe you can't answer it.
They have save on AOL, which puts your emails saved. And I've got about 500 or more saved. My question is there a limit to how many they can save for me?
Probably not a limit that you're likely to reach. Disk space and the way companies such as AOL and Google and the others are storing disk space is so massive, the amounts of space are so massive that you would probably have to have tens of thousands of emails saved before you'd even begin to approach any of their limits. You can probably, I'm not familiar with AOL directly, but you can probably hunt around a bit on the AOL site and ask for, look for things like quotas or capacities, but you're very unlikely to reach it with any of these companies because they recognize that people have a lot of information out there.
Well, I've searched around and tried to find out if I could ask AOL or anybody else to find out about it, and I thought you'd be a good chance to answer my question. And like you say, I was told one time when we used to have to pay to be on AOL a monthly fee, and the guy told me then that when I called in and asked about technical questions, he said you can save your AOLs on AOL forever. I thought he said, but I didn't know whether he was from the Philippines or what. Sometimes they weren't too good at answering the questions. And I've always had a question in my mind because I have many of the AOLs saved, my emails. I sure don't want to lose them.
Right. Well, forever is
a long time.
A long time. Probably forever would translate to several years. The only thing that might eventually happen, and it depends on their policy, is after enough years go by and there has been absolutely no activity, nobody is logged on, they may well move it to an offline archival site where it won't be immediately available unless you call them up and or email them and ask them about it. But there is another option that you would have, which you might want to consider with all the email that's stored on AOL. There's the ability of having that email stored also on your local machine. You could, and I don't know whether it's going to just make a copy or actually transfer to the local machine, but you would have to check with AOL. And once on your machine, you could then use any number of utilities and record it or save it onto a CD and have a more permanent archival copy of that if it's something you absolutely don't ever want to lose, as well as keeping it online.
Well, I have a backup hard drive.
Which will also work, but if you want to make sure that all of the email that is stored on AOL is backed up, you'll have to specify to AOL that you would like to have a copy of all of that, of all of those files that AOL is storing on your own local machine as well.
Well, I think my backup is supposed to record everything that goes on my machine, isn't it?
Yes, but if the email itself is not stored on your machine, the backup can't get it. So if you go to AOL or any of the other online email sites and write the email, you're not actually storing it on your machine. You're storing it on AOL's machine or on Gmail's machine.
I get you, yeah. Well, it is a very convenient thing because it is stored according to the date.
Right. Well, most email programs will do that, and it's also convenient because if it's stored online, you'll be able to get to it from almost any place.
Well, the thing is, if you have any idea, the only thing is I have trouble remembering things, so I can't remember what month or day or what year I'm looking for, you know.
Right. Well, even more of a problem once you have 1,000 or 10,000 emails.
Yeah.
It happens to us all.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Peter Kimball is our guest this afternoon. He's with the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois, and we're talking about computers. Next, we go to a listener on line two. Hi. No? Okay, let's go to a listener on line three. Good afternoon. Line three?
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, I guess he put me on the wrong line there. I have a video question, such as yesterday I took like a short video with my camera, and it was about 100 megabytes. And when I try to email it to someone, it takes forever, and then sometimes it doesn't even go through. It starts all over again. And is there some way I can downsize that file somehow? Is there anything already on my computer? Or do I have to buy something to do that?
You are running Windows or Macintosh?
Vista.
Okay, Vista. I don't believe that there is any program built into Vista that will include allow you to manipulate files. You're going to have a bit of a problem for a couple of reasons emailing such large files. Email accounts will actually have limits on how large an attachment can be, how large an accompanying file, such as a video file, will be.
Uh-huh.
What you might want to try doing is instead uploading that video to someplace like YouTube, and you can get the information by going to the YouTube site, and then emailing the people that you want to see it the actual location and address there. So you just send them a very short email that they then click on, and they can go and view that email. And YouTube and several other such locations are essentially designed for that purpose.
Okay.
And that will avoid the problem of people, for example, anybody at the University of Illinois with the University of Illinois email account probably could not receive a 100-megabyte file. It would simply be rejected by their email service.
Mm-hmm. Is that a pretty big file?
It is in terms of email, yes.
Oh, okay.
And as you discovered, it can also take a fairly long time, depending upon your speed of your connection, to upload. But if you were to send it to some place like YouTube or of other video sites, yes, you will still have to send it up once, so it'll be slow one time. But once it's there, it's very easy and quick for other people to access it. You just need to send them the appropriate location. And you can find out how to do a lot of that by just going to YouTube and clicking on how to upload, and it's fairly
simple.
Okay,
thank you.
Uh-huh.
You're welcome. Next, we go to a listener on line 3. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes. Mr. Kimball, I have a Sony computer purchased 2 years ago used, and all of a sudden, when we try to turn it on, it says boot failure. Disk boot failure, and it says insert system disk. Now, we have no system disk with us because we bought it used. How do I get a system disk?
Well, I don't think I've got any very good news for you. When it was running, I presume it was running Windows XP?
Yes.
The system disk or system boot failure is an indication that it can no longer read the files it needs to read from the hard drive. That may be because a single file is just somewhat damaged, or was not the disk drive is not able to play it back as it should, or it could be a slightly more major problem with the internal hard drive.
Well, we actually recently bought something that a piece of gadget that stored files, backup files.
Yes.
And we left it on. Is that possibly a problem?
That shouldn't have presented the problem, because generally what those backups, so this would be like an external hard drive?
Yes.
Those generally are not going to change the contents of your hard drive, other than a file that they write that just keeps track of what they're doing backups. But the actual files that it needs for booting up, while they might be copied, should not have been touched by that backup device at all. So I doubt that that was the problem. Hard drives do fail. They fail sometimes gradually and sometimes all at once. It's hard to know from just being told that it's a boot failure how severe that problem is. As far as getting a new boot system disk,
yeah.
The difficulty is you're going to have to, presumably on another computer, try to find some place that is still making available a Windows XP disk. You can no longer buy them at retail. They're no longer being sold because Microsoft is selling Windows Vista, and you really don't want to try to install Vista on the older machine.
Yeah.
But there are a number of sites, and you'll want to make sure that they seem to be fairly reputable, and they accept a credit card, so that if it doesn't work, you can always block payment via the credit card company. But since you have no way of certifying that you have an authorized license of Windows XP, there's really no good way of getting a disc that's not going to cost you something.
Okay, now if I went to an Apple store, like there's one at the Union, and part of the purchase is to take my files from my old computer and put it in the Apple. Will they be able to do it?
They might be able to. It depends upon what actually went wrong with the hard drive on that machine. Certainly, if it's only a few files that are there, that hard drive could be plugged into various devices that could just read the hard drive. It could even be plugged in as a secondary hard drive on another PC, and the files read, unless the hard drive itself has failed in such a way that it's no longer working, and that's why you don't get the boot file not found. And there's really no good way of telling whether that's the situation or not until you actually try that out, because there's no way of reading those files on your machine until you can actually have a machine that will start up.
Now, if somehow I get myself a disk for Windows XP, a hard disk, systems disk for XP, you think that might solve my problem?
It might. It might, again, if the problem is one where the hard drive has actually failed and it's a fairly significant failure, you'll be able to start up the system from the CD, but you will not be able to go much further than that. If that happens, and if you've got a somewhat technically knowledgeable friend, you could actually – now, is this a laptop or a desktop machine?
It's a desktop.
Okay. So it would be fairly easy for someone with a little bit of computer experience to open your desktop up, to temporarily remove the hard drive, plug it into their system as a secondary hard drive, and see if they can read it.
I see. Thank you very much.
Okay.
You're welcome. Let's take another call, a listener on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, this had to do with your Gmail comment about somebody not being able to receive Gmail emails sent to themselves.
Yes.
It happens all the time with me. I can send it to myself with no problems. And if I'm on a listserv that has mine on there and I send it out, I'll get back an email of what was sent. In my settings, I have it where it says forwarding and pop IMAP. I have the IMAP enabled, because I also read my Gmail on my iPod Touch.
Okay.
So I don't know if it's just a setting thing they need to do, but I send myself email all the time just to remember things. Like, oh, David, remember this? Mm-hmm. I'll just email it to myself, and it comes into my box with no problem.
Well, that could actually – the IMAP and the POP are two different ways that mail can be retrieved, and it could well be that Google or Gmail is handling the POP mail, which is what most people use because it's simpler and it's generally more sophisticated mail systems that are using IMAP. So that could be a possibility, but it's good to know that at least with your setting with the IMAP that you've had no difficulty at all.
I have a Macintosh and I use my mail program and I have my iPod Touch, and so I can just check any email anywhere and only it comes back as I've already read it, which is wonderful.
Yes,
that was my only comment.
Okay, well, thank you.
Next, we take a call from a listener on line two. Hello.
Hello. This is a follow-up call from about defragmenting or getting rid of temporary use programs.
Yes.
Okay, I have a Macintosh, and I was under the impression that that when you turn it off, that it automatically does that.
I don't believe it does it when you turn it off. Automatically, although it does whenever you have a system software update. One of the things that the Macintosh does do, if you sort of watch the screen, not real exciting thing to do, as it's doing the update, is it will say now optimizing. And one of the things it's doing when it says now optimizing the software is indeed defragmenting. Apple doesn't actually endorse any particular defragmentation software. But they do there are a number of websites about defragmenting Macintosh software, and I presume you're running OS X on the Macintosh. And let's see, the general advice that Apple says is that you probably don't need to defragment on the Macintosh because hard drive capacity is so much greater that it's got all sorts of extra space, and it doesn't need to fill up every nook and cranny of the hard drive. And the Mac OS does try to avoid reusing those space from deleted files as much as possible, so that you're probably not nearly in as much need of defragmenting on the Mac OS as on others.
Okay, well, thank the listener for her call. Next, we go to a caller on line 3. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Yes. What would cause I have a laptop, Windows XP, and what would cause the inability to do a system restore? I've been having a problem with Adobe Flash Player and Java running programs online that utilize the Java. And I've gone through the remove programs and whatnot and tried to reboot them, but the Adobe Flash Player just says that my system, the operating system, isn't supported, which I don't understand because it does. But I tried to do a system restore, and nothing. It won't let me do it. It says it's incomplete and nothing has changed. And I actually talked to someone at Geek Squad, and they said that it's probably a corrupt file. But then it would cost a few $100 for someone then to go in and try to figure out what's going on. Any advice?
Well, I'm just – so when you attempt to do the restore, you simply click on I want to restore and nothing comes up or...
No, I will go to a date. I'll do a previous date.
Uh-huh.
It'll go through all the things. You know, it'll shut down and turn on and whatnot. But then it gets to a point, and then a window pops up, and it says system restore incomplete. Nothing has been changed. And my only option is to just close the window, and everything is as it was.
Well, let me see what I can find here. There is a system, and you're not running out of hard drive space, I presume, because if
no,
you're almost...
I've got about 65%, according to, you know.
Which should be fine. And so the general, and I'm just taking a look to see what I can find here. And so have you, the other, and you want to restore to an earlier date.
Yeah, just to see if that would fix what the Adobe Flash Player and my Java stopped working after updates.
Well, one of Microsoft's posts in their technology base is that as you're going to do a system restore, before you do the restore, to turn off antivirus temporarily, because active antivirus can find something during the restore and try to clean it, and it may delete it, and the system restore won't work. So that is one of multiple possibilities, but that's just one. And that was actually on a Microsoft support. The other thing I would do, since we're beginning to run a little bit low on time, is do a Google search for that specific message, system restore incomplete. Put the whole thing in quotes so it'll actually bring it up, and you'll see, well, I only got about 1,800 hits. somewhere in the first dozen of them, hopefully, you'll find what you want. And the suggestion I just gave you, which was about the Microsoft posting to disable antivirus while doing the restore, was the second or third hit that I found on that page.
Well, I will start there.
Good luck.
Okay. And we'll take one last call here, but we'll have to be brief. We've got about, I'd say, 2 minutes tops. Line 1, hi.
Hey, I'm very brief.
Okay.
I have a laptop I've had about 6 months. It doesn't have any problems. There's problems in my brain. I would like to know who I can call to sit down with me and pay money for an hour just to say, okay, this is how you do this, this is how you do that. Like tutoring session or some little quirky things to clear up. Who can I call?
Well, is this a Windows or a Macintosh?
It's a Windows.
Okay.
It's Vista.
Windows Vista. There are a couple of computer dealers around that if you call them and ask that question, they may be able to find someone for you. Now, I don't know what their fees would be. Certainly, you probably don't want to go into the big box stores. The other possibility would be to – are you in Champaign or Urbana?
Yep.
You could also call one or the other of the high schools and ask to speak to one of the people. You'd have to do this probably after 3 o'clock who deal with some of the computer technology, because they may well have some students they could recommend as a possibility. Obviously, 15, 16-year-old students, or even some are 11 and 12-year-olds, but have so much expertise. I would go with the slightly older ones, because they don't get quite as enthusiastic and fix things that don't need to be fixed.
Right.
But that would be my suggestion. And better than that is if you've got any friends or neighbors up and down the street who have a computer savvy early teenager or even a later teenager, they would probably be more than thrilled to come, and even for a relatively small compensation, if any at all, would be able to run you through a lot of that.
Cool.
All right.
Thank you.
Good luck. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that'll do it for this month. Peter, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're quite welcome. It's always fun.
Solving lots of problems this afternoon here in the Afternoon Magazine. Peter Kimball is the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST-3 Consortium Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois.